This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. Hillary Clinton, in a staged event with Christiane Amanpour on May 2nd, bluntly stated that she would have been president had the election taken place on October 27th of last year, just before FBI Director James Comey made damaging allegations against her. Still, very few people were predicting back then that Donald Trump would win the presidency even after the Comey allegations. But one prominent person spoke out, predicting correctly that Trump would win. That same person is now predicting Trump will be impeached, and he has written a book laying out a detailed case for it. Alan J. Lichtman is a distinguished professor of history at American University, former associate dean of the College of Arts and Sciences, and chair of the Department of History at that university as well. He has authored or co-authored 8 books, including the award-winning book FDR and the Jews. And his latest book that he now joins me to discuss is called simply The Case for Impeachment. Welcome to the program, Professor Lichtman.
Thank you so much. Good to talk to you.
So there's much to be, you know, we could have a whole conversation on how it was that you predicted Trump's win, but let's focus on impeachment. There is a constitutional method for impeaching presidents that begins in the House of Representatives and the Senate. However, the last time such a thing was, successfully, or the time that people really remember a strong case for impeachment was President Nixon's. He resigned before it could go through. But at that time, Democrats were in the majority in the Senate and House. This time, it's the same party as the president. How could and why would the Republican Party, with its majority, impeach their president?
Several reasons. First, I wrote my book, The Case for Impeachment, as the people's guide to impeachment, because the framers of the Constitution very explicitly put impeachment in the hands of the people's elected representatives, not in the courts. And if the people demanded, impeachment will occur. I lay out 8 possible grounds for impeachment of Donald Trump. And my book is a guide so the people can see when Donald Trump will have crossed the line on any one or more of those grounds to demand impeachment. Every member of the U.S. House of Representatives will be up for re-election in 2018. And if Republicans come to believe that Trump is a liability to their survival, which is the first rule of politics, they may be willing to dump him. In the example you bring up of Richard Nixon, in the House Judiciary Committee, more than a third of Republicans join with the Democrats to vote at least one article of impeachment. Right now, assuming the Democrats stand firm, it would take only about 24 Republicans to defect and vote for impeachment to get a majority in the U.S. House. That's just 10% of House Republicans. Moreover, many of those Republicans may prefer to see Mike Pence, the predictable conservative Republican as president, rather than Donald Trump, who's a loose cannon, a wild card. Trump is much like Andrew Johnson, the first American president to be impeached, in that he has no longstanding relationship with the majority in Congress and has actually clashed with them a number of times. Finally, the kind of remote scenario, but it's looking less remote all the time, is that 2018 could be a wave election that sweeps the Democrats into power, in which case all the political calculations change.
So let's go through these cases that you lay out in your book. You make 8 broad cases, the first one being tied to one of the first actions that Trump took while in office, which was to try to impose a travel ban. He didn't like to call it a Muslim ban after he assumed office, but that's what he referred to it during his own campaign. And the courts very correctly basically said these bans are unconstitutional. They used his own words to make those cases. Trump doesn't seem to have much respect for the Constitution, which is interesting given that the party that he is a member of, at least just for the last few years, proudly proclaim allegiance to the Constitution. So how could this Muslim ban and his now 2 attempts at putting it forward form a strong case for impeachment?
His defense of the travel ban, particularly the first one, was very Nixonian. In the case for impeachment, I point out that despite very different backgrounds, Trump and Nixon are very similar. They both see themselves as beset by enemies. They see themselves at war with the press because they want to control the entire narrative around them. They're very suspicious. They have little respect for the Constitution, the laws, or the truth. They're not guided by core principles other than what's good for themselves. And we saw much of that emerge in the defense of the travel ban. We saw, like Richard Nixon, Donald Trump disregarding the clear mandate of the Constitution, which is checks and balances, and to claim absolute presidential power in this realm. We also saw him, as you point out, disregard the separation of powers when it came to the courts, attacking individual judges, attacking the legitimacy of the courts themselves. Very Nixonian. And finally, very much like Richard Nixon, we saw Donald Trump blaming his own troubles, his own attempt to promulgate a travel ban, which not only violates the Constitution, but tramples on decades of American traditions regarding immigration. He tried to blame it on the press. And he attacked the press in some ways more publicly and more vehemently than even Richard Nixon did. So there are all these hallmarks of abuses of presidential power that smack of a return to a Nixon-type era.
Then there's the issue of straight-up lying. I remember when Bush, George W. Bush, was president, and he was accused repeatedly of lying. And, of course, the Iraq weapons of mass destruction issue was clearly, you know, something that was a proven dishonest, you know, dishonesty. But the president and several of his surrogates have basically been caught making claims that they simply cannot justify, to the point where even the mainstream media is using the term lies in headlines. So, why would this make a strong case? How strong is it in just 100 days or so? How strong is the case that lies could undo his presidency?
You know, he's been president for 100 days. It feels like he's been president for 100 months. That's how much he has shattered precedent and tradition. You point out George W. Bush. His lies. Donald Trump specifically said that he believed that George W. Bush should have been impeached for lying us into the Iraq War. And he was very disappointed in Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi for not pushing that impeachment. So once upon a time, Donald Trump himself recognized how serious presidential lying can be. And he's lied about everything big and small. One could argue there's even an impeachable offense with his libeling the former president of the United States by falsely claiming that that president personally wiretapped Trump Tower and saying he was bad and sick for it. But more seriously, if Donald Trump does lie us into a crisis like the Iraq War, that would clearly be impeachable. There are also lots of civil suits pending against him that don't have to do with the presidency. But if the courts say that one or more of those civil suits can go forward, he might, like Bill Clinton, have to testify under oath. And given Trump's lifelong propensity to lie, he could find himself in the Bill Clinton impeachment trap, that is, lying under oath and being impeached for perjury.
The next case that you make in your book is high crimes. This one sounds the most dramatic to me. And and we should also sort of preface this part of our conversation with this notion that a president doesn't need to commit crimes with, you know, evidence or have evidence of crimes committed. It can be a political instability, right, that the Congress could make the case for to impeach the president, or do they actually need evidence of crimes committed?
You absolutely do not need evidence of crimes committed. The Founding Fathers used very broad language in interpreting what is meant by high crimes and misdemeanors. Alexander Hamilton, as I quote in my book, said, impeachment occurs when there is some serious harm and threat to our society, which could come in many forms. And he said, ultimately, it is denominated political. That's why it's in the hands of the U.S. Congress. So if Donald Trump is abusing the powers of his presidency, if he's smashing through checks and balances, if he is undermining the freedoms and liberties of, say, immigrants in the United States, if he violates the laws against torture or other laws that he decides to disregard or constitutional principles, then indeed the way the framers have interpreted high crimes and misdemeanors, all of that could be impeachable. We tend to think of impeachment as this, you know, horrific, traumatic event. Not true. The founding fathers thought the opposite. They put impeachment into the Constitution as a peaceful means of guarding our democracy against a rogue president without resorting to assassination or revolution, which was the way typically rulers were removed at that time. And none of the impeachments that we've had, or the near impeachment of Richard Nixon, have harmed the country. The impeachment of Andrew Johnson was a good thing for the country. Although he wasn't convicted, he moderated his policy of obstructing Reconstruction, the integration of newly freed slaves into the Union. Richard Nixon's resignation averted a president who was a clear and present danger to our Constitution, our political system, to the integrity of our institutions. And the impeachment of Bill Clinton didn't hurt the presidency at all. Many would say the presidency emerged stronger than ever after the impeachment of Bill Clinton, who also was not convicted by the Senate. Remember, to be removed, a president not only has to be impeached, he has to be convicted by a two-thirds vote of the Senate after a trial.
Right, right. So there, it's a multi-part process. Let's examine cases 4 and 5 together. They appear related. One is, you say there's major conflicts of interest, given that he is, you know, a businessman with hundreds of business interests and is now overseeing U.S. policy. And also case number 5, the violation of the emoluments clause, where basically through his the policy setting that he does, and even just favors that he might appear to be doing for other heads of state, or other heads of state could essentially be putting money into his personal pocket by them patronizing his businesses. Those two have been touted a lot by the press. They are the most obvious problems for somebody with zero political experience and a very, you know, businessman with very broad business right. interests all over the country. We've never had a president with this sort of business background, have we?
Well, those who've had a business background, like George W. Bush or George H.W., they've divested. They're not profiting. They don't know what's going on in their business. I recommended that Donald Trump needed to divest. He hasn't done that. Yes, he may have turned over his business to his children. That's pretty nominal. He still knows everything that goes on in his business. He still profits from everything that happens in his businesses at home and abroad. You mentioned the emoluments clause, which has suddenly become part of the American political vocabulary, something no one ever heard of a year ago. Simply put, the emoluments clause says that a president cannot receive anything of value from a foreign country, their entities, or their agents. And by the way, it's an absolute prohibition. There's no amount specified, and it doesn't require a quid pro quo. And already, Donald Trump has crashed into the emoluments clause. For example, while president, he received final approval for 38 potentially very lucrative trademarks from the nation of China. I don't know if we can get into the possible quid pro quos, such as his not declaring China a currency manipulator, and shortly before that, moving away from a two-China policy. But equally important, although it doesn't involve the emoluments clause, are the conflicts of interest at home, which even though they're not explicitly constitutional, could still lead to impeachment. Not every, but so many decisions of the Trump administration are directly going to affect the profitability of his domestic businesses. Decisions on trade, on regulation, on labor, and of course on taxes. Analysts have shown that Trump's tax plans can net him savings personally of hundreds of millions or maybe even billions of dollars. And here's the rub, and here's why this is so dangerous. The American people and the Congress should not be guessing where the national interest leaves off and Donald Trump's pocketbook interests kick in. That's why I recommend that in the case for impeachment, the only answer is divestiture.
And of course, we haven't seen Trump's tax returns.
Of course not.
You also make the case that his treatment of women could land him into trouble with the presidency. I would like to think that the Congress would take this seriously enough. But frankly, I'm not that confident that they care enough about women's rights. But you have a really interesting quote from 1999 that I had not seen. I mean, we've seen the Hollywood Reporter tapes and the way he's talked about grabbing women, etc. But this quote that he sort of admitted to himself, that his treatment of women would be a liability, is really interesting. In 1999, he told the New York Post, "People want me to run for president all the time. I don't like it. Can you imagine how controversial I'd be? You think about him, Bill Clinton, and the women. How about me with the women? Can you imagine?" I mean, some might say that Trump would like others to consider him a womanizer, but that he's not really that much of a womanizer. It's more just bluster and bravado and machismo. But can his treatment of women actually be an impeachable offense?
Yeah, he's got plenty of bluster, but let's not forget about a dozen women have said, yes, he did to me exactly what he's blustered about.
Yes.
And Donald Trump claimed he'd be submitting all this evidence, debunking all these women. And of course, that was more bluster. It never appeared. And here's how it might come back to doom his presidency. One of his accusers, former Apprentice contestant Summer Zervos, has filed a civil suit against him, not for sexual harassment, but for defamation, because she claimed he defamed her by calling her accusations and those of other women phony, made up, lies. She claims he subjected her even to all kinds of threats and intimidation. And her lawyer, you may have heard of her lawyer, she's the famous feminist lawyer Gloria Allred. And she said she wants to get Donald Trump in a courtroom. And as I mentioned before, if this kind of civil suit goes forward, and that's a big if, Donald Trump may well have to testify under oath. And he's either have to going to admit that, yes, I did sexually harass her. Or if he did sexually harass her, he's going to have to lie under oath. And either way, he's in serious trouble, and that could lead to impeachment. And remember, impeachment is not limited to things that occur while you're president. There's
right.
No limitation on what you could impeach a president for.
So Donald Trump's entire public career and his entire, you know, anything that he might have done before the presidency is certainly a fair game then. I feel like your case number 7 out of your 8 cases for impeachment is the most important. Crimes against humanity.
No
the steps that Trump is taking to doom the planet and the health of the human species by undoing all of the work that his predecessors have done, modest work, sadly, on staving off climate change, imperils not just the country, but the planet. I would like, again, to think that enough Democrats and a few Republicans would come together and say climate change is a big enough issue to impeach a president over. How would you make the case to them?
It's more than a big enough issue. You know, typically we think of crimes against humanity in terms of violent genocides, like what happened in Cambodia in the 1970s. However, just a few months ago, the International Criminal Court prioritized crimes against the environment, which of course would preeminently include climate change. Now, I've got to go back to 2009, a group of businessmen wrote a letter to then President Obama saying the science is irrefutable that unless we take strong action against climate change, the consequences are going to be catastrophic for the planet. And they went on to say such action would not harm the economy, it would actually help the economy by moving us into the future of a truly new and green economy. That letter was signed by Donald J. Trump, Ivanka Trump, Donald Jr., and Eric Trump. What has happened in 7+ years? The science has only become more compelling. The threat has become more immediate and more urgent to our survival and well-being on our planet. The only thing that's changed is Donald Trump's calculation that he has to join the discredited ranks of the deniers to make it in Republican politics. And he's not only thwarted efforts to combat catastrophic climate change. He has thrown it into reverse, arguably committing a crime against the environment and therefore a crime against humanity. Now, I know the International Criminal Court doesn't have jurisdiction over the United States, but imagine the reverberations if someone in a foreign land, because climate change affects everyone, brings a case against Donald Trump in the International Criminal Court. My goodness, that would reverberate across the world.
Absolutely, and it would be good for the fight against climate change as well. Finally, let's focus on the issue of alleged Russian interference. This is our Russian connections. This is a favorite issue among the Democratic Party. And there is some sense that some people are upset that it might be an exaggeration, that we're going back to the sort of Red Scare era where everything Russian related, you know, makes people hyperventilate and you know, be paranoid. But what are the well-established cases? What are the well-established connections between Trump directly, not his surrogates, but him directly, and the Russian government or operatives in Russia that could be problematic in terms of his presidency?
Well, this is nothing like the Red Scare, say, of the McCarthy era. It has been established by, what, 16 or 17 of the United States intelligence agencies that not only did Russia interfere in our election, they did so with the intent of defeating Hillary Clinton and electing Donald Trump. That part of it is well established. It's not hysteria. It's not something that's made up. Now, Donald Trump continues to try to deny and deflect that, saying this whole Russian thing is just sour grapes from the Democrats because they lost the election. No, it's the solid conclusion of virtually every intelligence agency in the United States, who, by the way, are not, those agencies are not filled with a bunch of hippies and liberals and Democrats. They tend to be very, very conservative. Now, the truth is, we don't know exactly what the connections were between the Trump team and the Russians, and whether Donald Trump knew about it or not. If he knew about it, that itself is a serious crime, failure to report treasonous activities. And we certainly don't know if Donald Trump himself was involved. But there sure is an awful lot of smoke. And usually when there's this much smoke, there is some fire. Let me give you a couple of examples without going into all the details that I cite in the book. The first is the interference in the Republican platform. The Trump team couldn't have cared less about the Republican platform. Nobody does, whoever reads party platforms. But they were passionate about one thing. They wanted to scotch, to eliminate an amendment pushed by Ted Cruz for arming the anti-Russian forces in the Ukraine. And they succeeded. And that was the only thing they did on the platform. And then they lied about it. Trump lied, said, we had nothing to do with it. His campaign manager, another inveterate liar, Paul Manafort, lied about it. Just a few weeks ago, J.D. Gordon, the guy in charge of the operation, said and admitted and confessed, yeah, we did it. That was us. And eyewitnesses at the meeting confirmed that. And shortly after that, guess what happened? All this huge leak of more than 22,000 Democratic emails from WikiLeaks. Boy, you know, the dots are pretty closely connected there. The other thing that I would mention is the administration's response has been very much like a Nixonian cover-up. If there was nothing there, why not put everything out in the open and tell the truth? Instead, what have they done? They've denied, they've concealed, they've deceived, they've delayed, they've deflected. And then when someone is finally caught with Russian connections, their answer is, oh, it was all innocuous anyway. Just like the Nixon team said, Watergate was nothing but a third-rate burglary. There's a lot here, and it's all in the book.
Well, also, you have a website where people can find out more about the book. Give out that website.
Yes, it's alanjlichtman.com is my website with all kinds of information about the book. You can get the book online at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or any other online seller. And I just found out today, we are an independent bookstore bestseller. And I'm pretty happy about that because I love these independents, you know. And
we are one of the bestsellers. And
the book itself, for a serious book like this, you know.
The book itself has a website, thecaseforimpeachment.com, with some details on there as well. We'll post links to both of those sites from our website later today. Professor Lichtman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonali. This was awesome.
My guest is Alan J. Lichtman, Distinguished Professor of History at American University and the author of the book we've just been discussing called simply The Case for Impeachment. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.